Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Well, let's turn now to the fourth day of climate talks in Paris and our ongoing series on Massachusetts' readiness for global warming. Today, former Vice President Al Gore addressed the Paris conference. He spoke about how global warming is affecting coastal cities in Florida.
I was in South Florida not long ago during the days of the supermoon, which resulted in one of the highest of the high tides, and there were fish from the ocean swimming in some of the streets of some of the cities in South Florida. It now happens very frequently. Then, of course, the projections are for so much worse.
And, of course, the problem isn't just limited to Florida. Every coastal city, including Boston, is particularly vulnerable to rising sea levels that come with global warming. So today we're going to take a look at what Boston is doing to prepare for that warming world, and whether or not it's doing enough. So joining me now is Julie Wormser, Executive Director of the Boston Harbor Association. Welcome to Radio Boston, Julie.
Thanks, Meghna.
Also with us is Paul Kirshen, Professor of Climate Adaptation at UMass Boston School for the Environment. Paul, welcome to you as well.
Thank you very much. Pleasure to be here.
A pleasure to have you both. And listeners, do you think that Boston or coastal Massachusetts in general is ready to deal with the changing climate? Have you seen things change where you live? Are you worried about rising sea levels affecting your neighborhood? What are you doing to prepare? And what do you think Boston and Massachusetts can and should be doing more aggressively to prepare for a warming world? Call us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 800-423-TALK. You can also find us on Facebook and Twitter at Radio Boston. So Julie and Paul, first of all, let me just start with the big question. Get your assessment. Let's stick with Boston for now. Given Boston's physical environment, the environment of the city, how ready are we? How vulnerable are we as the climate warms?
Well, there's good news and bad news. The good news is that we have one of the world's great harbors. We've got Winthrop and Hull and 34 harbor islands protecting us from giant storm surges. So a 30-foot wave out in the middle of Massachusetts Bay, by the time it hits downtown Boston, is a 2-foot wave. That's the good news. The bad news is that our ancestors knew this. They were mariners. And when they filled in a third of Boston to make more elbow room for themselves, they didn't fill it in very high. So it only is going to take a couple feet of sea level rise for us to start flooding chronically.
Wow. So I was kind of making a sick joke this morning about Back Bay really becoming a bay.
Used to be a bay. It wants to be a bay one day again.
Paul, your thoughts?
Yeah, I just want to add that Boston being a coastal city, you know, we have the coastal stresses, but also we get the inland stresses. So that means we're also going to have problems with extreme heat stress problems here. Also have problems with vector-borne diseases, other public health problems. Also problems with extreme precipitation. So being a coastal city, we get hit twice, from the coastal zone and also from inland stresses.
Okay, so that's really interesting. And I don't want to ignore the inland part of the picture because, quite frankly, most people live more inland than on the coast specifically. But let's stick with the water side for just a couple minutes here. So what would happen, Julie, if we hit that 2 degree centigrade warmer mark that the groups in Paris are trying to have us avoid as a planet? I mean, if we do warm up as much as could be expected, like, where will the water be?
Well, it's pretty clear that there's a lot of warming locked in already. I mean, we've hit about a degree warmer. It seems to me, and Paul is more of a scientist than I am, that around 1970, there was some tipping point where we started to see a lot more warming, sea level rise. We started to flood more since then. And so even if we stopped everything today, there's some locked in sea level rise already. We're looking at, projections out to the end of the century of up to 6 feet of sea level rise just between now and 2100. That would cause Boston to flood, a third of Boston to flood every year.
A third every year.
A third. All of the flat stuff in Boston is filled land. So the Back Bay would go back to the bay. South Bay goes back to a bay. Canal Street would be a canal, right? So if you think of a flat spot in Boston, it will flood when we get to that level of seas.
Paul, your thoughts?
Now also, Boston actually has, two storm surge barriers, Mia Earhart Dam on the Mystic, and then the Charles River Dam on the Charles River, the basin. those are only like 1 or 2 feet below the those are only 1 or 2 feet above the present 100-year flood. So if sea level goes up 1 or 2 feet, which we could see sometime after mid-century, when you get a storm surge, it's going to overtop
all
those
the time,
dams,
yeah,
and flood the Mystic River, but also flood the Charles River Basin all the way up through Harvard Square.
Uh-huh.
And so when a sea level goes up 1 or 2 feet, we hit a real tipping point in metro Boston because these hurricane barriers are not going to function as well.
Well, okay, and you said the hurricane word, because then we're also expecting, as you hinted a little earlier, just more frequently powerful storms, right?
Yeah, we're going to see probably intensification of hurricanes. The frequency may stay the same. But actually, Boston is more sensitive to nor'easters.
Mm-hmm.
And we aren't sure what's going to happen to them in terms of intensity or frequency over time. But in any case, they're going to be coming in higher. And the other thing about nor'easters, our winter storms, is they last longer. They last a couple of days. So we go through a couple of tidal cycles, whereas a hurricane blows through here in about a couple of hours.
Right.
So like Sandy, right? Sandy struck here at close to low tide. If it struck at high tide, it would have caused a lot of damage. So if we get a nor'easter, we're going to go through a couple of tidal cycles, and we're going to have we're a lot more vulnerable to nor'easters.
So some good news.
Okay.
Yeah, yeah.
The good news is we're not Bangladesh today,
yeah,
right? We do have a terrific city. We thank God have a political system where people believe that climate change is a problem.
That's a good start.
It's a really good start, and we actually have some time. So because of our topography, again, the flooding we're going to see is going to be chronic, not a tsunami. Okay, so the issue is we have a pretty major civil engineering project to do in the coming decades. We maybe have 20, 30 years before we have to do another kind of big dig level civil engineering project. Paul's saying maybe sooner. But, in terms of, catastrophe, we have the ability, the intelligence, and really the finances to do it. It's now getting the political will to prepare for a storm, which is almost unprecedented, instead of going through a storm.
Okay, so I am a very visual learner. Can you kind of paint the picture to me, both of you, about what kind of changes would have to happen? What kind of projects? Would we be building higher seawalls? Would we be putting, submersible dams further out into the harbor? What would we be doing to prepare for that tipping point that we might see?
So,
go ahead.
Okay, so a couple of comments, about good news. The city of Boston just launched in the last couple of months their first comprehensive vulnerability assessment, mm-hmm, to really understand the city as a whole, where we're vulnerable to flooding, and how we can start thinking about that. So that's a big step forward. And we're going to start getting results from that study in the next 6 months. So that is very exciting. Breakthrough in the city in terms of making progress and dealing with these problems. And but what might the solutions look like? So we just completed a study for MassDOT, and it's the most detailed flood maps prepared for the city of Boston. In fact, probably some of the most detailed flood maps prepared for any city in the world. And when you look at where the floods are coming from, you notice what we call flood pathways, where there's a natural low-lying area along the coast where the storm surges naturally come through. And there are probably like around Boston Harbor might be 10 of those.
Yeah.
So we could gradually build those up over time.
Mm-hmm.
And that would keep out some of the storm surge, keep the storm surges from penetrating inland. And moreover, we don't have to build all these up 10 feet high now. We can build them up in stages. We can do it flexible way, so as the sea level goes up, we can just build these walls up. So it'd be adjustable. It wouldn't be a huge investment right now. We can time our investment as the climate changes.
Mm-hmm.
But some things, cannot be protected by blocking off these flood pathways. And we're going to have to do other actions like, local flood protection, flood-proofing, elevating buildings. And then there's also all the ideas that the TBHA has put forward about living with water and which are living with nature and green infrastructure, which are also very important parts of this.
Yeah, so, Paul's right. The biggest thing we need is a barrier, Because once
the barriers.
Barriers, yeah, it could be small, and they could be, yeah, again, pretty short, but shoring up our seawalls that we have today and then raising them over time. But think, you know, we're not the first city to flood. We're not the first thing in nature to flood. So think like a duck and float. Think like
I don't want to be a duck, though. I'm a person. Yeah, no, but, I mean, seriously.
But you don't have to be the... It's not living in water.
Okay.
It's living near water in an enjoyable way. So there are parts of Holland that they're starting to put in floating apartment buildings, not just houseboats, but multi, you know, multi livable, you know, multi-unit floating condos. But that could be beautiful and really quite lovely. So, you know, think about canals. Think about salt marshes where water can go in, water can go out without harm. So we love living near water as long as it doesn't harm us. So what Boston might look like in the future, Boston during our lifetime is going to look quite similar. Boston in 100 years, in 200 years, might look like an archipelago.
This is a profound change,
this
though.
This is a profound change.
I mean, and
but we're up for it.
To be honest,
we can do
though,
this.
I have to say, I'm going to be the dour skeptic here. 100 years doesn't feel that far away for Boston to turn into an archipelago.
But you know what? And this would be cool to put on your website. If you go back to the Boston Public Library, the old photos of Boston 100 years ago. They were horse-drawn buggies. There was an elevated railroad. You know, so where the Greenway is now, there was an elevated railroad. Who knew, right? You know, it was all, none of it was paved. You know, Boston has done a tremendous amount of landfilling and land digging.
Okay.
We can do this.
Okay. So I'm going to come back to that in just a second, but I want to take a quick call here from someone who's probably, who is seeing changes happening at a bit faster rate. Jessica is calling from Plum Island. You're on the air, Jessica.
Hi. So I actually grew up on Plum Island, and a couple winters ago, we had a ton of bad storms that came in, a couple of nor'easters, and we actually ended up having a bunch of houses falling in the ocean because that big dune that's supposed to protect the barrier island got eaten away because you get all these kids who like to rip the grass out, and they just totally destroyed the dunes along the beach. And it's so interesting seeing how people just keep rebuilding their houses in these really vulnerable zones. And, I mean, my family has lived there for so long, but we've been near the marsh. But even then, I mean, there are days, like, we open the door, and I was like, oh, that's ocean water down my street. Hello, little crabs. Mm. So it's definitely, I don't know, I just... People are so, it's interesting to see how people, I don't want to say they're blind, but they're so in love with their home, in love
by
with
the water,
with their land.
Yeah. Jessica, I'm going to take it from you there because you make a really, really important point. I want to turn it back to Julie and Paul here because Jessica and both of you said we love living by the water. It's absolutely true. But with the changes that both of you have been describing that could come to Boston, I mean, isn't that a fundamental thing that we have to grapple with, that perhaps we shouldn't be living by the water so much? Why do we keep rebuilding in these very vulnerable places?
Well, this is the first time in human history that we've had external environmental changes during our lifetime, right? So, in you know, it's very human to think that the future is going to be an awful lot like the past. We're not ready for that change yet. And in fact, you know, as cheerful as the three of us are, there's going to be some suffering in the future. But John Holdren, who is from Harvard and now works for the president, he says we can adapt, we can prevent, or we can suffer.
How much is all of this going to cost for a place like Boston?
Well, we did the harbor cleanup. We did the big dig. It's kind of that scale, but then we have to do it multiple times, right?
So billions upon billions upon billions.
It's going to be billions, but it's also, it depends on what you do.
And who's going to pay for it?
Let me back up to the cost thing, if we could. Yes, it's going to cost a lot, but... in a way, it's going to provide us with an opportunity to rebuild a lot of our infrastructure. So if we rebuild Boston correctly and smartly, we'll have a lot of co-benefits to deal with a lot of other stresses we're facing to make a sustainable Boston. The other thing is, you know, my research and the research of others have shown that essentially for every dollar you invest in adaptation, you prevent like $4 to $20 worth of damage. And so it's going to cost us a lot more if we don't adapt than adapting.
Right, because I wonder. I mean, we're already seeing the costs of not adapting. You know, there's the economic cost we can measure. There's the sheer destruction for every major storm surge, and then there's also that trickles through the system. We're all paying different insurance rates, higher insurance rates. Mm-hmm. I mean, these are costs that we're already facing. But to get back to something, Julie, that you said earlier. Maybe we in Boston are sort of we're ahead of a lot of other cities and municipalities in terms of planning and political will. But what more would you like to see? I mean, do you think that we do have the political will to put the money to put behind the political will to marry those things to really get Boston ready?
Okay, here's where I kind of say bad news instead of good news is there's a great guy. At MIT, who did a study of Rotterdam, Singapore, and Boston. And so Rotterdam is a social democracy where they say, you know, we need to all pull together, tax ourselves, and do some central planning to protect our city from flooding. And they have, and it's very well protected. Singapore is essentially a dictatorship. They're going to tell people what to do. Boston is, even though we're liberal, we're pretty libertarian. We have very strong private property rights. We don't like high taxes, even though it's Massachusetts. We are much less politically equipped to pull together to do a central, big, expensive project. When we did the Boston Harbor cleanup, there were 43 cities and towns pitching in with, you know, their drinking water premiums. When we did the big dig, we had a lot of federal funds. Those aren't coming up. That's the tricky thing, Meghna, is that you are right that it is hard to pull the money together to prevent flood damage. I hope we can do this. Right now we have the dilemma that the money's only available for flood recovery.
Uh-huh.
I hope we're able to get ahead of it.
Paul, last thought goes to you.
I'm a little more optimistic, actually. Because I've noticed that the infrastructure agencies in Metro Boston, the MBTA, Boston Water and Sewer Commission, MWRA, MassDOT, Massport, you know, they have revenue and they have assets they want to protect and they have master plans and they have engineers and they have planners and they have, you know, they know how to deal with the political system. I think they're going to be taking care of their assets in light of climate change. They're going to protect those. And I think if we're clever, we can coordinate that protection with the protection of community and city assets. So I think with some really clever planning, coordinated efforts, we can protect, you know, we can protect all the stakeholders.
Well, you know, it's interesting. I promised listeners we would talk about inland concerns, and we didn't even get to those. So I'm sorry about that. We'll try to do that in a future segment because it isn't just water. It's, as you're saying, heat, disease, and all the things that come along with our changing climate. But Paul Kirshen, professor of climate adaptation at UMass Boston School for the Environment, thank you so much for joining us today.
Pleasure.
And Julie Wormser, executive director of the Boston Harbor Association, thank you as well for coming in.
Oh, what a pleasure. Thank you.
And listeners, keep sending us your thoughts on how Boston should be preparing for a changing climate. Do it at radioboston.org. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Stay with us. This is Radio Boston.